Up to the Lord.
Alleluia, alleluia.
Spread the news that He is joy.
Alleluia, alleluia. Sing in the mountains, sing in the meadows, sing alleluia, God is joy.
Lift your hearts up to the Lord.
This morning, as the crowd was here, it was just an amazing experience coming in here and seeing all of you from so many different places so many of you I recognize and some that I don't recognize. And for those of you who perhaps don't know me, my name is Nai Swami Jaya, and I serve in India. And here we have today with me is Nai Swami Shivani, serving in Italy, and Nai Swami Asha, serving here in the United States. We'd like to share with you a little bit stories, but also probably I think we'll make a few points as well. Yeah. At least that's our intent, at least. But I mentioned coming in here, the first time I came in here actually with it being finished like this was on Sunday when we had our program there. And when I came in here, I felt such an overwhelming feeling in my heart. It was like I was feeling emotional. And those of you who know me, I'm not particularly an emotional emotional fellow. But I just felt all of the weight of the memories, the past, the stories, the impressions, experiences that we've all had together. All of us, really, over 50 years. And I'd like to go back, and today I'm going to talk a little bit about 1969, maybe a little bit into 1970, and some of the lessons learned, and perhaps I think my compatriots here might mention that too. One reason is there's not that many of us that are remaining to be able to share those stories from that early time. But also, there's a lesson there for us in that. But before I begin, I'm going to start in 1973. And I said I was in here on Sunday, and I was looking out the window there, over there where the Pandal is. And it was in 1973 that I was standing right out there with Dr. Hoffman. Now, Dr. Hoffman was the fellow who owned this property before we owned it here. And he was a dentist, and he was from Los Angeles. And he had come up to show us this property that we were on. It was not actually part of the first part of our property. The border is about 100 feet over there, maybe 100 meters. And we owned the other side, but Dr. Hoffman owned this. And he had come up to show us that because we were interested in purchasing this land. It was so beautiful. And so he came and we walked over there. And he looked around. He was like this, showing us this beautiful meadow. And he told us that he needed to sell it. He wanted to sell it. But he had always wanted to come here and create something more than just a home for himself. He wanted to come here, and he didn't quite know exactly what it was, but perhaps it would have been a ranch for children, is one thing he mentioned, or a place where people could come from the city and enjoy the outdoors. He didn't have a formulated plan, but it needed to be something more. And since he had come to that point in his life where he realized that he was never going to be able to do it, he wanted to sell it to us. Because I feel that you can do something to fulfill what my dream is. And so looking out at it now, and I was looking back, remembering that, I think Dr. Hoffman would be very happy. Because his vision, unformed as it was, is what has come to pass. Now, let's jump back 4 years before that, 1973, and this would have been in 1969. I began to visit Swami Kriyananda in his home in San Francisco, his flat in San Francisco. I had met him in October of 68, took classes from him. But then he had invited me, after those class series were over, he invited me to his house, or his flat. And I'd been a student in Berkeley. Just prior to that, I lived in Berkeley. I would take the bus back and forth to his place. And I believe it was in early January. I'm a little fuzzy on the date. But I visited him at that time on a Thursday night satsang, what he would have, and he gave me a manuscript. And he says, I want you to read this. Now, those of us who have known Swami over the years, I bet many of you have seen him, and he's given you a manuscript. And he's asked you to read it. Now, what you learn from that is when he gives you a manuscript, he really does want you to read it. Well, unfortunately, I went home and I didn't. And I came back the next Thursday night, and he, sure enough, he asked me, well, what did you think? And I said, something like that. I made an excuse, and he was gracious enough about it. But what was that manuscript? I think some of you know what I'm going to say. It was Cooperative Communities, How to Start Them and Why. It wasn't yet in book form. It was in manuscript form. So you can be sure that the next week when I went home, I actually did read that manuscript. And speaking of reading that, I read it again just last week. And it's been 30 years, I admit, since I read it before. It's been 30 years past since I read it. He wrote that he must have been in 68 when he wrote it. So I saw it early in 69. And he rewrote it in the late 70s. And that was, I think, the last time I read it. And I read it again. And I was amazed reading that. And I recommend all of you, since all of you, this applies to all of us, Cooperative Communities. Here we are celebrating 50th anniversary of the establishment of this one. Read that book. Because in that book, yes, there's certain things that are dated. Yes, there are certain things that didn't quite happen this way or that way. And when his rewrite, he admits he took a few things out. But it's not about the externals, a guidebook, you might say, of do this, do that, do another thing. It was principles. And when you read that, when I read that, I recognized right away, these are the principles upon which we have built this community. And they still apply today. And I'd like to share just a few of those principles with you. Now, when I met Swami at that time, this was in early 69 when I read that, in April of that same year, I eventually moved up to the community here, but not here, at the meditation retreat, because that was the community. This property didn't belong to us at that time, so the community was actually forming at that point, but it wasn't much of a community at that time. There weren't many people here. I think I was number 9. There were 8 other people there at that time, and I came and settled in and immediately began to go to work, and I still remember to this day coming up and driving across those diggings up there, going to that place, saying, this is home. This is home. And this is why it's still up there. I feel that vibration that was so distinctive. And this is home. I finally had found a place where I could apply myself, where I could have a purpose. I had been somewhat of a wandering student, not knowing what my purpose is in life. And all of a sudden, I felt this recognition. This is what I want to do. And of course, at the heart of that was Swami Kriyananda. And it was, he could say, he was the foundation and the integral ingredient for what we're trying to do, because it was Swami who set the tone. And one of the very basic principles that I want to share with you is how he went, what he focused upon, particularly in those early years, that early year. People have asked us over the years, what's your secret? What's Ananda's secret? How did you do this? How can we do it? And the short answer is basically Swami concentrated not upon some formula, not upon a system. He concentrated and focused upon people and individuals. And this is one of the first quotes I want to read to you today, taken directly from his book. He says, it is time to press forward from a preoccupation with outward systems to a recognition of the real key of the efficacy of any system, individual man. The need of the hour is for self-unfoldment, a privately and deeply personal search for self-realization. And this is what he focused upon. He focused upon the upliftment of each individual's consciousness. Upraise that consciousness, community will follow. Now, I want to emphasize that point again. There is a principle that we must realize. If a person's consciousness is uplifted, there will be a natural impulse to be cooperative. It works that way. If a person's consciousness is uplifted, one will naturally feel an expansion of sympathy for other people. If there's not that upliftment, you face a lot of obstacles. And so the first prerequisite, and I think this is what Swami was doing, whether consciously or just was his nature, he was uplifting people's consciousness. And only with an uplifted state of consciousness was it going to be possible for community to happen. And community would happen naturally, inevitably, if consciousness is uplifted, because this is the prediction of the masters, what they have taught us. In this age, this idea of community will spread like wildfire. And why? Because it's natural to people's inner feelings of what they want in this age. Consciousness raises, people want to seek out the company of other truth seekers. And so with that, Swami was the magnet. He had such great magnetism. He was able to attract people of all sorts, just naturally. And I have to admit, I was attracted to him in that very way. But I'm not sure I really recognized it so much. I wanted to be there. Now, why do I want to be here? Well, of course, I mean, I'm playing the fool a little bit, but it was him. And he had that magnetism to uplift other people who were in his presence. And when you were in his presence, you wanted to cooperate. You wanted to do the right thing. You wanted to do something better and greater. Now, at that time, of course, you had many people starting to come. And they did come. They came in ones and twos at first. They came in threes and fours, fives and sixes. And pretty soon, they were coming by the dozens and the scores. And of course, we ended up eventually outgrowing the ability to have a community up there at that piece of property. And out of that came this. But again, it was that magnetism very subtly being guiding us. And out of that, our natural youthful idealism was able to be directed. Now, this is an art of leadership that Swami was able to exert. And I'd like to continue on that quote of the importance of the individual and see if this isn't so as we have grown over the years. It's about systems. Swami was not keen on external systems. Yes, you have to have some systems, but it was the individual behind the system, because you can have any system and you can make something good out of it. But you can have a bad system can be made good. But you can have the perfect system. But if you don't have people of uplifted consciousness and idealism, it's going to fail. It's up to that level of consciousness of the individual. So Swami went on to say, it is not his systems that bless man, but man who blesses his systems by having the goodwill to make them work. People of goodwill can make just about anything work. No system can create virtue. The most it can do is facilitate the development of virtue. For virtue is a development that must always spring from the goodwill of the individual members. There should be some system, some rules, but not with the view of creating goodness in people. The system is needed only to contribute, to coordinate the life of the community, not to be its salvation. You see, and I think this is something we should remember. It starts with the individual person, the individual soul seeking God. And I think this is what one of the secrets is of our success, is that we had at that time a group of, and to this day it continues, we have groups of people of goodwill who are seeking something higher. Now in those days, yes, we did have a lot of people coming seeking idealistic visions. And I like to use the image of a bottle of soda. You know how it is. You take a bottle of soda, and you all as kids, we all did this, I'm sure. You take the top off, you put your finger on the bottle, and what do? You shake it up, and you let the finger off, and it sprays all over. And then after it sprays, it gets all over you, and then it settles down. Ananda, summer of 1969. You had a lot of young people. Most of us, I mean, a couple of old people in their 30s. You had youthful enthusiasm and righteous enthusiasm to boot. You had idealism, idealistic people. And you'd put those in a bottle and shake them up and open the top and whew, you know. And that's what it was for a number of months in the summer of 1969. But yet, it was fun. Now, Jyotish may not use that word, but he was trying to coordinate, but for those people that were, it was scattered. It lacked a certain purpose. And so the important thing of what Swami's job in this, and of course others trying to help as well, Swami's job in this was not only to raise the consciousness, but to try to bring it to a focus. And my second quote here, or third, says, Swami's talking about the need for good leadership. People left to drift their own ways soon drift apart. Even people with the best intentions need coordination in a group endeavor. Give people the freedom to grow at their own pace with enough sense of common direction to help them grow together, not apart. Communities fail because of a lack of clearly defined sense of purpose. It is no accident that nearly all successful ventures have been religious. Now, so you could say these two elements of upliftment of consciousness and the giving of a sense of purpose is what Swami's work was mostly on, out, not necessarily outwardly, but inwardly behind the scenes in terms of the guidance that he's given us, to be able to give a sense of purpose to what we are doing. And he did that through his activities and his work at the meditation retreat, mostly that summer. Swami, as we've heard, and I'll reiterate, was extremely busy, extremely energetic, extremely focused in what he was trying to do, exertion of his will. He gave all of the classes and all of the programs every weekend, because the retreat, not only as being the spiritual hub of the community at that time, not too many people, lots of people here, but it was, like I say, it was scattered, not so much up at the meditation retreat, because that was in Swami's direct aura, physically. Every weekend, there would be scores of people coming for retreats. And so it formed that spiritual engine, but it was also an economic engine for the community. So Swami put a great deal of energy into that. And through that, it permeated out into the community. People would go there on the weekends, participate in those retreats, serve at those retreats. And it was through that beginning point, from the retreat, the consciousness, that purpose that we are here to serve Master's work, began to percolate down. Now, it took a bit of time here because we had people coming from every walk of life. Imagine scores of people coming together. We're basically strangers to one another. A few new people from other places, different types of backgrounds, different education, different value systems to some degree, yet of goodwill, mostly of goodwill, and trying their best, but there was, how are you going to apply that? So you could say the next lesson that had to be learned was, how do you actually apply this, bring this chaotic energy and enthusiasm into some sort of focus to be able to make a practical application of what we were trying to do. Swami used to tell the story of how he went to, he gave a lecture with a number of spirit, later, a few years later, a number of New Age celebrities, and they all gave a presentation. It was, I think it was in San Francisco, or anyway, it was, well, it's not important where, but and afterwards, they were gathered together, and he mentioned that they were all talking to one another, but nobody was really asking him for his advice. But of all of them, he was the only one who had actually built the community. The others were theoretical. Now, this is something important to understand about Swami's, too, his approach. He was not a utopian. In other words, an idealistic utopia is going to be created through this community. And this, of course, brings me to my next quote. Swami writes, he says, "Don't expect people to embrace a way of life too radically different from that which they are now accustomed." And so he encouraged us to apply ourselves. And he was not, as I say, interested in theory as much as he was interested in action. But it took a bit of passage of time for us to be able to take that enthusiasm and to apply it into practical application of doing something. And I think one of the things that helped us do that, and I'm moving a little bit further in the timeline here, is at the end of that year, you saw the video the other day about how Sadhana Devi made teepees for that winter. It was the onset of that winter that I think was very, very helpful for us. Because most people left. And they left, and Swami actually encouraged that. He encouraged it. Go back to the city, make money, bring back tools, bring back experience. And most people followed that advice, and they went. I stayed at the retreat, sort of as caretaker at the old retreat. But they left, and when they came back, it was good for us, because when they came back, we started anew. Because those people who came back were those who were committed. Those who were not here just for the fun and excitement of that first year, but they came back with the intention of building a community. And it was from that spring of 1970 that I feel that we really put our roots down. The first was, you might say, some of those plants that flower very quickly but then wither back down. But when you put roots down, then you begin the plant growth. And that's what began to happen in early 1970. I remember we had a meeting on the front lawn of the what's now Master's Market. There weren't many of us, but there was a dozen and a half people. And we had come to the realization that we needed to practically apply what these teachings of Yogananda were about. And it began with supporting the community. Swami had been supporting through the meditation retreat, through his classes up to that point. But that had to end. And we assigned to ourselves, we had a meeting of how much are we going to pay every month to make this community work? And the number was $65. I still remember that. Everyone was required to contribute $65 a month. And with that, we'd be able to pay the mortgage and do a little bit of maintenance on that. But that was momentous, actually, because with that, paying money every month, we needed jobs. And we're going to see a little video a little bit later about this very thing. We need to have jobs. We need to be organized. We need to have regularity. We need to have some coordination of what we're doing. And from that, the community then began to flower and begin to grow. Now, there's many stories, but my compatriots there, I may be getting restless if I go on too long. And I'm almost done. So let me just conclude by saying this. It's been a wonderful 50 years. But this is really, this is year one right now. This is year one of the next 50 years. Is that so? And it's all of us who have worked together who have brought us to this. And it's all of us who will continue to work together over the next 50 years. Some of you, I hope, will be there, some of the younger ones, at that celebration. And to be able to demonstrate how working together, cooperation, harmony, seeking God together, focusing our attention and our energy on a purpose of being instruments for the blessings of these great masters, and how what we do here, Swami predicted, and in a sense, through by extension, Master's prediction, this message of self-realization will go out into the world, showing the world how happiness can truly be achieved by working together and serving and finding God together. Many joy, many blessings and great joy to you. And one of these days we should have a long time to sit and tell stories. And I think we got, so I'll invite.
I have a question.
I don't know if I can answer questions.
Would you be willing to introduce a time for us to ask questions?
You know what you should do is you should tell the coordinators here, and I'm sure the three of us would be love to do it. If tell the coordinators one of these afternoon workshops, maybe we can set it up.
Thank you.
Okay.
So I've already been introduced. My name is Naya Swami Shivani, and I read Swami Kriyananda's Cooperative Communities, How to Start Them and Why, at just the same time that Jayaji read it, which was in January of 1969. Swami gave me the manuscript, and I read it. And I came back to the next lesson with Swami of Hatha Yoga, and I said, this is what I want. This is for me. And I wrote a letter, and I got an answer from somebody called John Novak, whom I didn't know, saying, please come. So I did come. I came just a couple months after Jayaji in June, so I was probably number 12. And I was certainly one of the carbonated bubbles in... And by the time I settled down, it was 16 years later. And that's when Swamiji asked Arjuna and I if we would go to Italy and help the work there. So for the last 33 or 34 years, that's where we have been serving. For me, for all of us, I think this is our first Kumbh Mela. You know. This is our Allahabad, this is our Triveni. This is where the three rivers are coming together of the devotees from the United States and from Europe and from India. And this is our Jubilee. This is our 50th anniversary. It's a lovely word. I love it. Jubilee, jubileo. It comes from the Italian word jubilare, which means to rejoice. And this is such a moment for us to rejoice together. I can't express what's in my heart because if I do, I'm going to cry, and I left my Kleenex back there. When the subjects were announced a couple months ago, I began to think about this subject of how we have manifested Dwapara Yuga principles in our life. And I posed myself a question, which I don't suggest you ask yourselves. And I asked myself the question, is it possible to encapsulate in one concept the center, the essence of all of Master's teachings, of all of Swami's guidance, and of the 50 years of experience of Ananda? What characterizes Ananda as a Dwapara Yuga movement? Well, since it's been weeks, and I've been ruminating, and I must admit that it's been invading also my meditation, there have been many candidates coming forward for that concept. You know, what is the bija of the Ananda movement? And many things were considered. People are more important than things. I knew somebody would talk about that. And then superconscious living, somebody's going to talk about that. Be even-minded and cheerful, that was a consideration. But the very first one that came to mind, and the one that just stayed all the time, as far as my experience is the first thing we learned when we came on the path of Kriya Yoga. What is that? The greater the will, the greater the flow of energy. And this is at the heart of who we are, of what we are, of our whole teaching, of how we act with ourselves. The greater the will for self-realization, the more energy that comes to us. The skies open up, divine possibilities. The ego, as we know, is the spokesperson for Maya. And what does it tell us? It's telling us all the time, you can't. You're too young. You're too inexperienced. You don't know how to do it. You're too old. You're too slow. You've been around too long. There's a new wave. There's new technology. Okay? So that's what the ego tells us. But the soul is the spokesperson for the spirit. And it's telling us something else. It's telling us everything is possible. There are no limits. The more clear our vision, the stronger our determination, the greater the flow of divine energy. And even all of us who have been meditating and applying these principles for years and for decades, we have only begun to open that door of superconsciousness and realize the immensity of power that's there for us to harness. But all we need to do is look around, and we can see that. One experience that has been very dear to my heart, a very little thing, you heard about making the teepees. And so we went to the forest, we marked the trees with the forestry department, we cut them down, we took off the bark, and then we put them up to dry in the form of a teepee before we covered them with the covers that Sadhana Devi had sewn. And so they were up there in the form of a teepee, but it was all open. One of those teepees was mine, and I loved to go there every night. I took my sleeping bag and I went right in the center of the teepee, and I just laid down and looked at the sky. And I just, oh, it was amazing. And just the thought, the sky is the limit. And that's what I felt that Ananda would be, not just for myself, but for every one of us. Limitless possibilities. We put forth our little energy, and the universe opens up. Master said about willpower in his book, The Laws of Success, to a person of determined willpower, if what he wants doesn't exist in the world, the universe will create it for him. And look what the universe has created for us in every moment of our lives. So let's look at this concept. The greater the will, the greater the flow of energy. Master used to say, and Swami as well, let's think about willpower as willingness. And what is willingness? It means to say, I will. Just so simply, I will. But, you know, we can say I will in two ways, and they're both good. We can say I will, and we put our will behind what we're doing. And this brings immense results. When I listen to Swamiji sing, My Lord, I Will Be Thine Always, and if you have a chance, listen to it. And perhaps it's not there, but when I listen to it, I hear Swami give just a little emphasis on the word will. I will be thine always. You know? When we say at the Kriya initiation, what do we say in English? I do, I will, I do in Italian, io lo farò, I will do it. And then there's another way to say that, which is, I will. Swami used to, and I'm saying this in a positive sense, Swami used to say, if you see something that needs to be done, do it. Don't wait for somebody else. Just say, I will. And this community has been built by people saying, I will. So now I'm going to tell you some stories, and I won't tell too many stories. I'm going to watch my time very carefully. Okay. Now, I was looking at Asha, not Jaya. I promised. I can't risk our friendship. Okay, stories. Little fast stories. So we needed to pay for this place. And Jyotish and Devi and I and Samjaya, you know, we had just arrived, and yet we needed to find a way to pay because Swami said, I'm not going to do this forever. I'm not going to pay the mortgage. So Jyotish went out, Binay went out. They went back to San Francisco to develop businesses. And Jyotish came back after having sacrificed that time with the incense business. And so we made incense. I have some fond memories of Jaya and I, freezing cold in the morning, going down to the incense shop, which was just covered with plastic, and the paste of the incense was frozen. We had to put it on the heater first, which was a stove. It had an, and we dipped the sticks and so forth. And Binay, he developed these, he went out and collected wildflowers, put them in resin, and then put them in little things for people to wear. Okay. These were the people that went out and brought back the means for us to pay that mortgage. Many stories. I'm not going to tell most of them. Another thing that was obviously so important, you know, we had to pay the mortgage. We had to eat to have the strength to go out and do things, to pay the mortgage, to go out and plant trees, to go out and sell candies, to go out and do all of the things that we did. So we needed a garden. So Swami invited a gentleman gardener with experience in biodynamic gardening. His name was Honnell Cassidy. Some of you know him, and I hope we keep alive his memory. And he took us, you know, raw young people who knew absolutely. I mean, I was 24 years old. I'd spent 22 years in school. And, you know, I never had my hands in the dirt. And Hanul said, we don't call it dirt. It's soil. Anyway. Soil grows things. Dirt is something where it shouldn't be. So he guided us, and there were many of us in the garden. There was Jayaji, there was Devi, there was Anandi, Sadhana Devi, many others, Kirtani. There, over time, so many people who worked in that garden, and we learned so much. Hanna was loving, he was a disciplinarian, but I think, at least for myself, that my spiritual path, that was my formation, la formazione, that was laboratory. That's where we learned things. We learned responsibility, we learned sensitivity, we learned to think about those plants and care for them. We learned that if you went home after 12 hours of working and remembered in your meditation that you hadn't turned the water off, you went back and turned the water off. It was a wonderful training ground for us. In those same years, not only food, but we also wanted milk and a dairy. And Nakula, whom you know in a certain role, Nakula said, I will start the dairy. And somehow, I don't know how he went out, it was one cow, two cows, three cows. It's where the goat dairy is right now. And he started that dairy. We had to eat, we didn't have enough food that was, grown in our gardens. And so one day Parvati said to herself, we need other food. We don't have cars, we can't go into town. We need to bring food here. And she said, I will. And she started Master's Market. Yeah. Just boxes, I remembered so well the first day when she put out those boxes, bananas. It was wonderful. in the garden we had beets and Jerusalem artichokes and squash, and that's what we ate all winter long. So bananas was really a great thing. So many people, just stepped up and said, I will. People needed jobs. There were families, people who were married. And so Arjuna started the Ananda Construction Company. And he employed many people. Here's Jaya again. It's like Jaya was doing everything. Dharmadas was part of it. Nakula was part of it. Drupada. Nirmala was part of the Ananda construction. She made the stained glass. When you go into the expanding light and through those doors, you see that stained glass. And she didn't say, I've never done this. I don't know how to do this. She did it. And so we learned that I've never done it and I don't know how to do it is not an excuse. The greater the will, the greater the flow of energy. One of my great concerns as the years went on and Swamiji was getting older and older, I was thinking, who is going to challenge us when Swami is not here? He put us in positions where we could easily have said, and certainly we thought, I've never done this before, I don't know how to do this. But when he would be gone, who would do that for us? Who would make us raise the bar? Who would make us jump higher? And what I've come to see, that it was a false worry on my part, because since Swamiji's passing, he's been doing it. it's like he can do it more right now. And so there are always, somebody asked us yesterday during the tour, do you have any difficulties or challenges here? And okay, Cesare, there's your answer. Okay, and I was thinking, my heavens, everything we've had and we've built, is always being challenged. Our farms are being challenged, our schools are being challenged, our very communities are being challenged. And what do we say? Thank you, Swami. Haribo. This is how we grow. The greater the will, the greater the flow of cosmic energy into our lives. So Swami continues to do it. And he does it as well through the living guides and representatives of our line of gurus. They are here to love us. They are here to support us. They are not here to coddle us. They are here to encourage us to be everything that we can and to be more than we think that we can ever be. And we ourselves have the responsibility to keep challenging ourselves in meditation. One of my mantras for the last years is by deeper, longer, thirsty, guru-given meditation comes this celestial samadhi. We must challenge ourselves every day, and deeper and longer, in touching that joy. Swami used to say, and it was part of his slideshow, the first slideshow about Ananda, the hallmark of spirituality is joy. So we challenge ourselves, and we challenge ourselves in our daily lives. There's no purpose in challenging others. We want to challenge ourselves. So this was the central concept that came to me. And I want to conclude with the honorable mentions of this, just very quickly. The others that didn't make it up into the first tier. And when, in the early years, Swami started and continued to create things that would embrace, that would enlarge, to say we are here to embrace everyone who wants to follow the spiritual path. And so he established what was called the circles of joy. And there were three of them, and each of the circles had a motto. The first biggest circle that would embrace the largest amount of people, the motto was, joy is within you. Joy is within us. It comes from our inner life. It's not the nice house that we have now in our pension and our social security and our investments. Joy is within us. And I think often about the names that Swami gave to his first, to his right hand and his left hand. The first was Jyotish, inner light. Joy is within us. Let's always remember that. Let's never get complacent. Let's never look outside of ourselves and remember where it is that we want to search. The second circle had as its motto, service is joy. Service is our joy. There's the classic picture, you know it, it's in the meditation retreat of Seva, and he gave the name Seva to his left-hand man. And there she is serving, and she served every day and was always there. And the last one, Dharma is my guide. And that's what we are here for. Yata Dharma Stata Jaya. Sister Genamata, when somebody asked her at the end of her life, if you had to do it over again, what would you do differently? And we know what she said. I would do it all over. More and better. That's what I say. That's what we say. And that's what we, the pioneers, are saying to you now, all of you, and the new wave. There's more to do. You can do it better. This is the challenge. The greater our will, the greater the flow of divine energy. Jai Guru. And now we're going to see a short film, and I have no idea what it's about.
Finally, we had some sort of dwelling space, even though it was primitive with the teepees. But we also realized that if we were going to continue to be able to stay in this community and create it and build it, that we needed above all to get some businesses going. And so I had the idea of starting an incense business. At that time, incense was quite popular. And within 2 or 3 months, I had developed a process of making incense actually from scratch. And that business grew. By the next year, I had added also little bottles of scented oil, which were also popular at that time. And the business continued to grow, providing many, many people at Ananda with a way to make a living. Admittedly, the wages were very low, but we were living extremely simply. About 2 years into it, we were selling nearly $10,000 per month of incense and oils, which for the economy of Ananda was a great deal of money. Those businesses in the early years were absolutely essential to Ananda's growth and survival. There were many, many entrepreneurs in the early years of Ananda.
I worked with jewelry. The first jewelry I worked with was making use of the resources from the land with the little pearly everlasting flowers. Some of them we would dye, and then we would get lichen off of the trees, and little chia seeds would represent the earth. Those were fun to me, and we sold a lot of them. Ananda Flower Jewelry was the name of the business. Later on, the jewelry that I was involved with was creating things for going out to shows and also astrological jewelry. Starting with a few businesses, we still needed to have more.
When I moved to Ananda in 1971, I had the great joy of joining Shivani, Devi, and a couple of other women in the Ananda candy business. We were one of the first businesses in California to make candy out of healthful ingredients because natural food stores didn't exist at the time. So that meant we had to learn everything that we did by ourselves, which suited our adventuresome spirit. We made candy bars out of raisins, dates, figs, carob, nuts, and coconut. That was our own bar. I have to say that the financial success of Ananda Candy was humble to non-existent, but it was a wonderful, wonderful place for us to learn about willpower and creativity, wholehearted willingness, and just have a wonderful time together. It was so important for me, and I think for all of us, to have that opportunity of serving selflessly and energetically toward a common goal with each other. It was a great blessing. And we had many small businesses to try to help support the community and provide jobs for people. We had a print shop for printing Swamiji's books and later Bharat's books. We had Ananda Construction, which was building houses in the village and also in the nearby town. Some talented people started a cabinet shop. We had a car repair shop, which was very, very needed out here. Shivani started selling harmoniums, and we had Ananda musical instruments. Someone started beekeeping and Ananda apiaries. And we had our wonderful Ananda dairy. But one of the most important things we needed here was food.
There was a lot of interest in back to the land and organic farming, and Swami Kriyananda realized we had to get some expert guidance, and so he invited Honnell Cassidy, senior disciple, to come and show us how to grow food. When we first started the farm, we didn't have any money, we didn't have pipes and irrigation sprinklers. Everything was done by furrow. Our fences were often inadequate, so
Ananda would sometimes sleep out in the field, which was a useless enterprise. It really didn't help.
I would get up in the middle of the night and throw rocks at the deer. They would go as far as I could throw the rock, wait till I got back in my sleeping bag and come back and enjoy more food. So need a little break for them, you know, between courses, I guess.
Certainly we've grown lots of fruits and vegetables, probably at least 36, 45 different varieties and crops. In a given season, we've yielded historically, and even now today, about 12, 13 tons.
We always had fun. Kirtani and Shivani and Anandi and Devi, all of us worked together and supported together and loved serving and meditating together. The market is still a great outlet for us.
Master's Market came into being in the spring of 1973. And the reason that it came into being was a dire need within the community here, the farm as it was called at that time, the main part of Ananda at this point. And the reason was there was no place to buy food. It was at a time when there were probably 100 residents here plus children. And so I thought, well, at least what I can do is buy a few boxes of fruit, of some dates, of some nuts, just have something where people could come at lunchtime and be able to buy some food. And so as the months went on, people kept saying, well, can't you have more? We need more food here. And we built shelves and we put in a refrigerator and we had a little cash register, an old time one where you hit the buttons and all of that. There always was the idea that the farmhouse was like a community center area where people could see each other. Not only could they get out of the rain and have a nice place to sit at noontime at lunch, but they could actually come in and see each other. And that was a big thing in those days.
Well, my husband and I, Vidura, came to Ananda in 1974. Ananda was very different at that time. We brought our two children, ages 8 and 11. And the two main thoughts were the words simplicity and freedom. The houses were simple or not at all. They were just teepees or tents or trailers or tree houses. The children pretty much ran wild, and we were comfortable with that. It was a very safe place to be. The school was 12 children from age 5 to 12 years old. They were all in one schoolroom. They had to learn how to get along with each other and value different ages, different ways of seeing things. So they built enormous tree houses, and they went on long hikes, and they learned about the flowers and the trees and the animals, and we lived with bears and mountain lions nearby, and how do you deal with that? There weren't any examples at that time of what it means to be a spiritual family, a spiritual parent. So we had to figure it all out ourselves. And so we had a horse, we built a corral right outside our home, and every day she would come home from school, and the image I have is her getting on Cinnamon with her hair blowing back and just bareback and riding off, this beautiful image of freedom and trust.
If I can try to capture a little bit of the energy of those days, it's just a kind of a spirit of adventure, some kind of unlimited adventure, unlimited, everything was possible, partly because none of us knew all the challenges that would be involved. The first building was an old chicken coop. First group, they were from 4 to 8 year olds, there were 6 of them. They took on the project wonderfully. We found some saws and nails and hammers, and they made their own desks and chairs to sit in. When it got too cold, then this building that we're in right now, it became available not because it was finished, but because the community had run out of money. So then, of course, you need heat. So we decided we would use oil. Well, the reason we could use oil is because oil comes in big barrels, 50-gallon barrels, and you could roll the barrel down the hill to the school if you were careful. And how do you do a bathroom? Well, you get a book out of the library and you figure out how to put in a bathroom. So anyway, everything was possible in those days, but the school started to take off. Mind-bogglingly for any of us who were here in the 1972, but now there are schools in Slovenia and in Europe and Italy. We'll probably have one in India soon. And of course we have the ones along the west coast of the United States in Portland, Seattle, and Palo Alto and here. In your wildest imagination, you couldn't have thought that this would spread that way. The only person who had a clue about that, of course, was Swami. He knew the depth of what we were working with, the power of this vibration that we had got from Master. And he knew that it was stronger than anything else on the planet.
He said constantly, from 1972 in the summer when I arrived, constantly he would say, if you see something that needs doing, do it yourself. In other words, make it happen. And I kept hearing him say that, and that's why I responded by thinking, I can do a market. I don't know anything about markets. I don't have any money, and there's very little room, but I can do this. He was really behind things like that happening and really encouraging and really more than encouraging, saying, this is a community. If you want it to happen, you have to do it. He couldn't do it. That's the way a lot of things happen. They were ways that really brought down out of the ether Master Yogananda's ideal of world brotherhood colonies, of a cooperative world brotherhood community that would have a reality, that would have a living reality.
It was a very, very creative and joyful time. We were all young, we were all energetic, and there was this sense that if it could be done, we were going to do it. And so we took on whatever challenges there were, and it was a wonderful, wonderful learning experience.
Show that video before I spoke, but it was a really, really bad idea. I was just trying. My topic is supposed to be how did Swami do it? You know, which everybody's been talking about. I recently, you know, you have Mother's Day is the whenever in May, and then you have Father's Day in June, and as it happened, both of those Sunday services were assigned to me in our church in Palo Alto. Father's Day kind of crept up on us, and all of a sudden I realized we had to talk about it. So it was a very interesting thing. We always talk about Mother's Day, but often we forget to talk about Father's Day. And so very recently, I had to do that. And just sitting here right now, I realized that's how Swami did it. He was the perfect mother and he was the perfect father. You know, the mother, Master described the Divine Mother as the comforter. That's how Jesus put it. I will send you the comforter, is what Jesus said, which is extraordinary to contemplate. And I've contemplated it a lot, because in the course of all these 50 years, a lot of things happen and a lot of comfort is needed, a lot of different times. And we go onto the path with all these different unresolved inner realities that somehow or another we've made a decision that this is the lifetime that we're going to resolve them, or at least this is the lifetime we're going to continue to be, or at least we're going to start to be serious about them. So you get onto the path. In the early years, like everybody else, I did lots of different things. And I remember I was sent by Swamiji up to this communities conference this was different. Shivani and I went on a lecture tour. Shivani and I went on a lecture tour, and we had this big slideshow of Ananda that we showed in many places. We traveled for about 6 weeks. And I would show these gorgeous slides of this extraordinary place, and people would like it, but then, especially in America, Americans have great hearts, but they really never, Americans, it's very important to be shrewd if you're American. So you're always, your first impulse is to open, and your second impulse is to suspect. As Swami said, I'm of two minds about America, is what he said. So I would show this slideshow, and everybody would just love it. And then people would become suspicious about it. And this, I would get this question repeatedly. Well, of course, you can make it work out there, but what about the real world, they would say. And for about 5 of those 6 weeks, I would take the question about the real world really seriously, and I would give whatever glib answer I had. And finally, I think I just got tired and got a little crabby. But it also crossed my mind that they were talking about the unreal world. And the real world is when you decide that I have certain things within myself that must be resolved, and I am determined to resolve them. And you know, that's not a free ride. The free ride is when you say, I have certain things in myself and I am determined to distract myself from ever having to deal with them. You know, by all the things that the world ever increasingly just makes sure. I bought gasoline driving up here, and in the, you know, 3 seconds it took me to get my credit card in, I got to watch television. It was just like, are you kidding? Anandi said many years ago about all the noise, whatever you do, don't ever be alone with your thoughts for any moment, anywhere. You know, this is the real world, this commitment. And it's a very strange mixture of absolute blissful freedom and joy like you can never imagine, and the hardest work and the most painful revelations that you're ever going to face. And that's where Swamiji was able to just make it work perfectly for us, because he was always the comforter. And I don't mean by that that he was always supporting us. I remember when we were having a controversial period in the community, and there was this big sort of movement among people who then left about the fact that the leadership wasn't listening. And I think it was Davy who finally just encapsulated it. I'm listening, I hear you, I just don't agree. So it wasn't that Swami comforted us by encouraging us in our delusions. And this is where he had this perfect balance of the father and the mother. Because what the masculine does is it looks to the top of the mountain and it says, we're going to go there. I have no background in sports at all. Just, it's never interested me. And in our school, Craig Kellogg is one of our school teachers, and he's been a big hockey player, and he stands out in this room because he's a big man. And I saw him once with one of these very little boys, and the little boy had tumbled off his bicycle, and you know, and Craig very lovingly took him and cleaned his little wound and put a Band-Aid on. Then Craig has this little boy's hand, and they're going together, and Craig says, walk it off, Mateo, walk it off. Which is apparently a term of art in the athletic field that I had never heard before. But I watched that little boy straighten up his spine, and he was just walking it off, you know? And that's what Swami was for us. He would just bandage your wounds when bandaging your wounds was what was going to help you to go on. And when you just had to walk it off, you just had to walk it off. I remember one time some woman was going through some personal tragedy at the bottle. That was, and I had to come. Swami often had me in the corner when he was counseling people. He was training me to counsel, and I was present a lot of times. I don't know why. But he was so loving to this woman, and she was weeping, and he was comforting her, and it was so sweet. And then when she finally left, I also had some really tough issue that I was dealing with. And you know, I thought, oh goodies, you know. That was actually the time I told this story a Sunday or so ago. The actual issue had to do with writing, which is interesting because that's been what I finally mastered now, but it was about writing. I had an assignment. I didn't feel I could do it. I was just a pathetic heap of helpless inadequacy. And so I'm presenting to him this helpless inadequacy. And I can't exactly remember how it happened, but I was sitting there, and I think I had finally put my head down, and I was crying. And I became aware of the fact that Swami had walked away. Oh, no, it gets worse. It gets much worse. He had walked over to this drawer. I was his housekeeper and his cook, among others, so I knew what was in his house. And in this drawer, we kept flashlight batteries that had become a little weak, But we were so poor, we couldn't really throw them away, so we'd store them, and then we'd get the best ones, and we'd stick them back in the flashlights. And so there was a little voltage meter, and you would test the batteries. And I'm like, this is not a job you do when you have anything else to do. So Swami's over there. My life is falling apart. And I realized that Swami is testing the batteries. And he's putting the good ones over here and the bad ones over here. It's just like, what? I just couldn't believe it. And I kind of tried to get his attention. And, you know, he was cordial, but not comforting. Not comforting. And somehow or other, I extricated myself and I walked up. Then I was mad. I never doubted him, but I was annoyed. And I was so annoyed that I sat down and I wrote the damn article, you know? I just did it. I just did the work. And I gave it to him, and he was always very honest. I was saying to some of you yesterday, he threw away a lot of my writing. But this one, he said, oh, this is very good, like this. Now, when I told this on Sunday, I forgot the last part of this story. Like 3 or 4 days later, and I've never actually ever seen him do this before or since. 3 or 4 days later, there was a community satsang. And in the satsang, Swami says, Asha had a very important spiritual test this week. He said, and if she hadn't passed it, she might have left the spiritual path. He said, I'm pleased to say she passed it. And then he said, I would have helped her if I could have, but she had to do it herself. God. How often do you have a friend like that who just knows, you know, knows exactly and is not driven by, I want you to like me, this is what we do, this is our technique, you know, nothing like that. Swami had one interest, which was our spiritual well-being. And it wasn't something, I mean, some of us had actual physical experiences with him, some of you, it's an inner friendship. It's only an inner friendship. But his conversation, I was talking to Netri and Jivta this morning where I'm staying, and Netri works the garden. She and Jivta are largely responsible for the tulip festival and all of that. And Netri was just sitting there saying, he just keeps telling me what to do. And she says, she has these conversations with Swamiji about Swami wanted certain things done before the 50th anniversary. And she was saying, I tried, sir, I just couldn't get them done. He says, well, I want them by next year. Because he knows more than we know what we're capable of, you see. And you see, that's the perfect mother and father. The mother just loves us unconditionally. I remember once Swami was in seclusion, and I got myself into one of those, you know. Just I shook the bottle, and it just blew up all over, and it made me really sticky, and it made a lot of other people really sticky. It was... And it made, you know, the place where I was working really sticky. Everything was really sticky. But he was in seclusion, and I didn't want to bother him. But Seva told him that I was in trouble. And so Swami summoned me, asked me to come see him. And when Swami was in silence and seclusion, conversation with him was he would sit at the typewriter. You would stand behind him and speak, and then he would type the answer. So somehow or another, we sorted out whatever little mischief I had been up to at that point. And at the end of it, I was very grateful, of course, and we were walking from in the dome from where his office was up to the door. And when we got to the doorway, I said the kind of thing that people say to each other. Oh, sir, I'm so sorry that I had to trouble you. I really wish that I hadn't had to interrupt your seclusion. I mean, we think that's what we should say to one another. Swami looked very stern, and he motioned me all the way back, and we had to go back to the typewriter. And he said, I am your friend. He said, if you thought that my convenience was more important than your welfare, he said, you would be insulting my friendship. He said, this is what I'm here for. Now, many, many times over the years, I've thought about that, because that's one of the ways, you see, we protect our delusions. We say we're not really protecting our delusions, we're just being considerate. I'm just not going to ask for help. I'm just not going to bother Swami. I'm not going to ask Kirtani or Dharmadas or someone to help me or Jyotish or Devi. I'm just going to, and we don't know what we're actually doing. And what the father image does for us is the father image says, yes, you will face it. And the mother side says, no, no, I just get to snuggle down, you know, I just get to hide like this. The true mother comforts and then pushes you toward the father, you know. And that's what Swamiji did for us. He made you feel safe. I remember a particular time he really had to scold me. He had to scold me in front of other people. That didn't happen just once. But this particular time, I had caused a lot of trouble, so we were having a little reconciliation. And I got defensive. If I hadn't got defensive, it probably would have come out differently. But I got defensive. And when I got defensive, he just couldn't let me. He just couldn't let me have that. So he pretty much allowed everyone else to be right and me to be wrong. And I knew exactly what was going on. I knew that I was responsible. I could watch the whole thing play itself out because I knew him well enough. And I knew that I'd triggered it by my own behavior. But, you know, at least he wasn't checking his batteries. You know, it could have been worse. But it was so sweet. Like, as we were all leaving, somebody just asked me to stay. Which was not unusual because I often cooked for him or something. But he just asked me to stay, so no one else would have thought it odd. And we just talked for a couple of minutes, and we didn't talk at all about what had happened. But he wanted me to be sure that I knew that nothing that I had done had changed his love for me. And he just kept me there maybe 5 minutes. Until he was absolutely certain that there was no doubt in my mind. And then he just sent me on my way, like that. But where in the world do we find someone like that? And it's still there. You know, to those who think me near, I am near. And if you shut me out, how can I come in? These are the words that Master spoke, but they speak as clearly to Swami, from Swami, as from anywhere else. And it was just that there was a woman who came to me once, and she was telling me she had a lot of issues of self-worth. And, you know, she was a wonderful person, and her only flaw was that she didn't know she was wonderful. You know, this lack of self-worth just clouded all the virtues. But she actually wondered whether she was loved by God. And of course, I can't speak for God. I could do my best to reassure her, which I did. And after she left, I started thinking about the fact. I said to myself, I've never doubted that God loves me. And God knows I'm not always lovable. So it wasn't because I was perfect, and therefore I knew he was never displeased with me. But when I really thought about it, I realized that I know God loves me because I know Swami loves me. Because one person who constantly radiates that kind of friendship to us. When I was privileged to write the book, Swami Kriyananda As We Have Known Him, and that's a collection of people's experiences, and some of them are mine, but many of them belong to others, and I traveled around a bit among the Ananda communities, and I made appointments and I sat with people. And I would have people sit in front of me. And some of the people are names that you really know, people who've been leaders of Ananda forever. And others were people that I didn't even know as long as I've been here, because they never had a very notable role. And some of them had a hard life. You know, they were tired out kind of people. Because we're all devotees, come in all shapes and colors. And I can type without looking at my fingers well enough to get the notes. So I was able to just sit there and type and make eye contact with people without having to break eye contact. I could just keep typing. And people would just tell me, you know, sort of what experience it had been. Now, you know, I have thousands of hours of experience with Swamiji, and somebody would tell me the one time they spoke to him, or the letter that they got, or what happened to them when they listened to a song. So this was not all personal, or what happened when they saw a video, or the first time they came, you know, or anything like that, the first time he came across their life. And some of the faces were radiantly beautiful, and some of them were wizened and tired. But the eyes, oh my, the eyes. You could just see that God is center everywhere. That nothing that we think is the real measure of who we are is the measure of who we are. It's all so trivial and so incidental. There is only one reality, and that reality is God within, shining forth and finding its way back to infinity. And then specifically, people would tell me how hearing Love is a Magician for the first time, you know, or singing one of Swami's songs, or seeing a picture, or hearing a poem, or having him speak. And just as they would tell, I would just watch. I would watch everything else assume its actual proper place, which is nothing. And the only thing that mattered was the light of God. Swamiji said once, very early on in a satsang that he gave at his dome there, and he said, and it had been just an extraordinary night. He would have these satsangs like every Thursday or so in his dome there, and 30 people, 40 people sometimes would come. And in the winter, when it would get dark very early, and we go down to the gas lights, and you know, there's nothing but the canyon on the other side. Really, we could have been on the moon. There was no other world there. And one of those nights, Swami just took the energy really out as far as we could go. And then he, from a great distance, he said, when God realization comes, he said, all of your incarnations, you'll just see that they were all just shadows and light. And they'll all just fade away in the dream nature of all those lifetimes and all those fulfillments and all those tragedies. He said, you'll just see that they were just shadows and light. And the only thing that you will see that really happened were those moments when you touched the divine. He said, and they will just shine through all those lifetimes, these points of light. And you know, sitting there with Swamiji, I thought, ah, I will remember this. This will be one of them. When everything else is gone, we will remember when God touched us through whatever instrument, we will know. That's been the great gift of this life that we have, and this is the gift going forward. This is the gift for all eternity. Everything else is a dream. And aren't we lucky? Yeah. God bless you. We have a responsibility now to all our yet unmet brothers and sisters who are just waiting for that touch of spirit to call them. And that's our job. So why don't we all stand up now? I was saying yesterday, and I'll say it again now, every one of us had a moment when something happened and we turned toward the light, and it was the beginning of our journey into Master, to Swamiji, to Ananda. And somewhere, somehow, some magnetic force was sent out that was strong enough to touch us. Someone did that for us, and now we must do it for everyone else. So let us feel the extraordinary gift that has been given to us, that we are all here together. And let us gather that gift through the power of the Om and send it out into the ether that every unmet brother and sister will receive the call and respond.
Om.
Let's pray together. Heavenly Father.
Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Friend, beloved God.
Friend, beloved God.
Jesus Christ.
Jesus
Christ. Babaji Krishna.
Babaji Krishna.
Lahiri Mahashaya.
Lahiri Mahashaya.
Swami Sri Yukteswar.
Swami Sri Yukteswar.
Beloved Guru.
Beloved Guru.
Paramhansa Yogananda.
Paramhansa Yogananda.
Saints of all religions.
Saints of all religions.
Dearest friend.
Dearest
friend. Swami
Kriyananda.
We offer our lives,
In
devotion and service,
at
your holy feet.
May
thy love shine forever,
on
the sanctuary of our devotion.
And
may we be able
to awaken thy love
in all hearts.
In all hearts.
Peace.